All right. So, last time I spent most of the time talking about the non-abelian extension of measure theory with W-star algebras, and I started talking about the continuous case of C-star algebras, and I gave what I think is the critical example of pseudo-differential operators. We had a manifold M, compact manifold, pseudo-differential operators starting with order zero. It had a symbol, which was the continuous function on the sphere bundle. And the redundancy of choices here are the compact operators. This was all on L2 of the Riemannian manifold relative to the volume that one was talking about. This redundancy, I mean, as you know, that if you have a symbol in the cotangent bundle, you don't know which operator, the choice of operator, the amount of choice is given by a compact operator. I also remind you that in here, we had scaling, say, by if we took a Laplacian plus the identity to make sure it's invertible, and took minus 1 to the half, that goes into 1 over the absolute value of C. So it's scaling, and then you would have not only the zeroth order, but inside of here, if you multiply, you would have order minus 1, minus 2, etc., going down for these operators. Moreover, we can always tensor the whole situation with a vector bundle E. I just won't. All the hard part is doing it for functions as far as the analysis is concerned. Tensoring with a vector bundle where these will then become matrix valued or HOM EE valued operators. It will no longer be true that, say, A bracket B, if they started out at zero order, it will no longer be true that the bracket is of order minus 1 because the symbols needn't commute their matrix value. But if one were diagonal, then the bracketing would be okay. And at least when the symbols do commute, I remind you that then the symbol of this, say, the minus 1 part of the symbol, because the zeroth part would be 0, will go into the symbol of A plus on bracket symbol of B. Finally, this inability to go backwards is an algebra. You can't take continuous functions on here and pick these operators so as to preserve multiplication, means that this is a non-trivial extension of continuous functions on S of M sphere bundle by compact operators. This is the beginning of what's called EXT theory for these commutative algebras, and that was developed by Brown, Douglas, and Fillmore. This is not Mike Douglas, but his father, Ron Douglas. I had the many happy occasions of collaborating with Douglas Sr. in the past, some years ago, on things of this kind. But the point about this X theory, it's another way of describing cohomology, or homology, I should strictly speaking say, for the continuous functions. One way or another, this algebra is the prototype of many interesting things where you're trying to reflect the topology of the space as opposed to the measure theory of the space. Now, of course, I think some of you were confused.
First question. you said last time that this algebra actually depends on the Riemannian metric on the steps as well.
Well, in the sense, yeah, in a number of different ways. First of all, I had to tell you what Hilbert space there was, so I needed the volume element anyway. That's just the volume element. You know, this is a star algebra, so you got to have a representation. But I would say what really happens is that if you took another metric, you would just get sort of an automorphism of this system. That's all. I mean, the algebra would be the same, but how you would specifically make your choices depends on the metric. More interesting, by the way, is this. After all, if we these are really symbols on a cotangent bundle of M minus zero, and you have symplectic automorphisms of this system, and you might ask yourself, well, a symplectic automorphism will map this space to itself. Can I extend it to an automorphism of the pseudo-differential operators? Turns out you can, and this is these are known as Fourier integral operators operating on L2, but by conjugation they give you an automorphism, and that automorphism coming down to the symbol level is a symplectic automorphism you started with. So the whole system is, shall I say, robust. It reflects the symplectic structure very well in the operator theoretic sense. Well, let's look at this in a special case where the manifold is S1, and you know these operators, but I want to remind you of it for certain reasons. So the manifold is S1, and of course the sphere bundle over M, since it's one-dimensional, the sphere are two points, and the sphere bundle is just S1 union S1. So here's my base circle, and there will be two circles with the vector pointing in one direction and the opposite direction. So the symbols, the space of symbols, continuous functions on S of S1, will just be pairs of functions, F and G, one on one circle, one on the other, for F continuous function on S1. Are there new flowers out flowering these days? I've suddenly acquired an allergy to something. I don't know what it is. Well, pairs of functions. So F and G are functions of S1. One is a function on this circle, the other function on that circle. It's just a union of the two circles. Now, the basic operator here, aside from multiplication by functions, is this one. Suppose we took dd theta. That's an operator of order 1. Let's divide by the absolute value of dd theta. Now I've got an operator of order 0. I really would like to have it invertible. So I'm missing the constant, so let's add to it the projection on constants, which is a compact operator, so the symbol doesn't see it. What is the symbol of this operator? It's plus 1 here and minus 1 there. And what is this operator? This operator is, I'll write it two-way, projection on the non-negative spectrum minus projection on the negative spectrum. Or put another way, if you want to think of L2 of S1 in terms of Fourier series, it's plus 1 on e to the I k theta k greater or equal to 0, and minus 1 on e to the I k theta for k less than 0. That's the operator. So this operator, let's call it E, its projection on the non-negative spectrum, and So this operator is 2E minus the identity, where E is the projection on the holomorphic part. So you can think of, I need hardly remind you, you can think of then we have, what is E of L2? This is the harmonic holomorphic space, that is the boundary values of holomorphic functions from the disk is what the range of the projection, because their Fourier series is just in for positive, non-negative K. Well, without going through the details, you can see that if we want to analyze this algebra a little bit more, we could play the game of the direct sum and the various pieces, but really we might as well just look at the symbols on one half, on, say, the positive and not the negative. It'll be comparable if we work with both. So we just want to look on those operators which are living on sort of half the space, the holomorphic space. These are called Teplitz operators, the ones we get. So we define T sub F to be, well, I'm only going to be working on the holomorphic part of the space, that's E. I'm going to multiply by F. I'm going to put E back. So what this does is, if you wish, you take a positive Fourier series. F is just some function on the circle. You multiply, but that may give you negative coefficients. You kill the negative coefficients. So, for example, T of e to the I theta, that's very nice. It just shifts e to the I k theta into the e to the I k plus 1 theta. But T of e to the minus I theta, it sends 1 to 0 because it shifts down to a negative coefficient. And then when you project, you're losing the negative coefficients. And it sends e to the ik theta into e to the ik minus 1 theta for k greater than 0. No, remember, I'm only operating on the holomorphic part of the space. You can easily check that from the general point of view, the symbol of T sub F is just F on one of the circle we're talking about and 0 on the other part. And it would have a comparable. I want to take this a little further. For reasons that will become clear. Theorem. This is due to Helton and Howe. Suppose X and Y are self-adjoint operators on the Hilbert space, and X bracket Y is of trace class. Note, by the way, I should have put theorem after I've done all these developments, but okay. Note that if we let T be X plus IY and T star to be X minus IY, that T star bracket T will be equal to 2I X bracket Y. So we're also saying that T and its adjoint are bracket of T and its adjoint are of trace class. So now let A be a polynomial in two variables. And B, a similar polynomial. And let the corresponding, let A be the corresponding operator. Consider the bilinear function which sends A and B into the trace of A bracket B. This is skew in A and B. Let's call this omega of A and B. Now, you may object, well, I took a particular ordering here, but if you check, it really doesn't matter where you put the x and y's, because when you commute one past the other, you're taking a bracket. That's a trace class. The trace class operators is an ideal among the bounded operators, so you're not going to be... The difference between how you did major choices would be a bracket, and the trace of a bracket of trace class operators is zero. So this is a nice functional on polynomials in the plane. Skew symmetric functional on polynomials in the plane. Now I can state the theorem. Omega of A and B is equal to the integral of the Poisson bracket of A and B against some measure in the plane. This compactly supported because it's giving you a functional on polynomials that are growing very large. Quick proof. This is so elegant, what else could it be, right? Now, let's talk about the case of... I'm not going to... Let's talk about the case of Teplitz operators. If F and G are smooth, then T bracket F, T bracket G is trace class. It's always a compact operator because the symbol is zero when you take the bracket. But if these are, you don't need full smoothness, but some smoothness, then they'll be of trace class. And now the question is, what is trace of T sub F bracket T sub G? Well, what you do, these are functions on the circle. They can be complex valued now, so we're not talking about self-adjoint operators. So here we have two functions on the circle. Extend them to the interior, so they're now functions on the disk. And the answer is that this is equal to the integral over the disk of the Poisson bracket of these two functions, dx, dy. On the other hand, you know that this expression, very special in the plane, is the differential wedge dg. So by Stokes, this is the integral over the circle of f, if you wish, dg d theta, d theta. In particular, suppose F is invertible. Or G is invertible. Suppose G is invertible and set F equal to G inverse. Then the trace of T sub G inverse, T sub G, is equal to the integral of S1, G inverse dG d theta, which is the winding number of G. So we're getting something topological here, which was the point of this exercise. And in fact, if you track this a little further, you can see that what you're getting is minus the index of the operator G. So you're getting minus minus 1 to the F for this particular operator G. I give this example because... Oh, yeah. Sorry. I should have said that. The basic theorem is that if G is invertible, then T sub G is a Fredholm operator. I.e., it has finite dimensional kernel and co-kernel, and the range is closed. It has an index, and here's the formula for it. Now, the wrong proof that you're getting the index is minus the winding number, a correct but wrong proof, is, well, you know the index is a homotopy invariant, so you only have to check this result on each homotopy class. Right-hand side's an invariant, left-hand side's an invariant. And each homotopy class, you might as well take G to be e to the ik theta, wraps around k, then just check that you are getting the index here, because you know exactly what the kernel and co-kernel are and what this is going to be. I say it's the wrong proof because it's kind of too easy in the sense that you're just checking every possible example, and you're seeing that two things are equal by checking every possible example. But the Helton Howe development actually gives it to you and gives you the sort of the index formula directly without checking all possible examples. In my mind, there were really three different proofs of the index theorem. The first one we had was, in a way, a generalization of checking all possible examples. We showed that the index of Dirac was a cobordism invariant. And so all you had to do was check it on cobordism classes, and that was like this proof. The heat equation proof, which eventually became this beautiful proof in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, is more like this proof in the sense that it gives you the answer, and you're not checking all possible examples. The third proof, which is very much involved in non-commutative, the one that was generalized in non-commutative geometry, is where we axiomatized what the index was, and we showed that there was a unique map from operators to integers which satisfied the axioms, and then we checked both the analytic formula and the topological formula gave you that answer. Just satisfied certain general axioms that made it unique. And that's really what happens in the non-commutative case. Well, let me go on. I wanted this example because of this projection on positive spectrum and how much information it really gives you. We'll use that twice. So my next topic is the quantization, deformation quantization. Of Kalin manifolds. M with symplectic form, I'm going to assume that omegas in integral 2 form for what I want to do. Now, first I want to say what I mean by deformation quantization. So I'm going to look at, in this case, C infinity functions on the manifold M. Let's call this algebra A. And what we want is an algebra which is formal in the sense, well, it's usually written this way. By that I simply mean the elements in the algebra is an element of A, A0 plus 1 over T, A1, and so on down the line, where the T's are just formal expressions. And we want a multiplication between functions to look like this. It will be a sum of certain bilinear, this multiplication is not to be commutative, bilinear in F and G with the property that B0 should be equal to just the product in the ordinary sense. It's in this sense that we want a deformation. And B1 to be equal to 1/2 the Poisson bracket of F and G, where we have a symplectic manifold because of the 2 form. And we want this multiplication to be associative. So you see that if we took F star G minus G star F, it would kill the first term, and the next term would be 1 over T times the Poisson bracket of the 2, etc. So in that sense, it's a deformation of the Poisson structure of this algebra, meaning that we've got this notion of bracket. And the other conditions that you want is that BJ are local in the pair F and G. By local, I mean that since it's bilinear in F and G, you can think of this as being a functional on M cross M, where F and G is replaced by F of X cross times G of Y, if these are the variables. And local means that you're talking about a differential operator on this in the X and Y coordinates. That's just what Poisson bracket is like. It's partial in both F and G.
These are formal series.
These are formal series. There will be a C-star algebra I'm going to get to when I quantize. But here we are. This is just what's called, and then you want a linear functional. You can arrange things under reasonable conditions that you have a trace tau of F should be tau of G-star F. And you can rearrange things if you have one so that, in fact, tau of F is equal to the integral over the manifold of F omega n over n factorial for this 2n manifold. Now all this... Pardon?
So tau is valued as formal series.
Well, no, tau is... No, I meant by tau is that it kills everything else. It's only functional on the first term. Thank you very much. It's F0. There's a theorem I'm trying to avoid that says that if you had a tau with these conditions, you could transform it so it's equivalent to this one. Now, what I want to describe briefly is an actual quantization of this algebra. That is, I want to exhibit briefly a deformation quantization, where what you have on the right will be the symbols, like we had with pseudo-differential operators, the symbols of some operator algebra, but the operator algebra will actually quantize, meaning that we're going to get an operator algebra. For the moment, I'll pretend it's like pseudo-differential operators, so that this modulo an ideal of compacts, or actually the smoothing operators, will have as its symbol this deformation algebra. And it's in that sense that I'm talking about quantizing a Taylor manifold. Now, there's some very interesting issues here. The description I've given so far doesn't really depend on having a Kähler manifold, only a Poisson structure, because all you're using Poisson bracket. Recently, Koncevich showed how to get deformation quantization for functions on a manifold. I've seen what he did, that is, his description of the BJs. Nobody I know understands what that description really means. However, the scuttlebutt is that that description is coming out of string theory. Well, perhaps you can explain that later. Okay. The problem I want to pose there is that gives you the sort of the symbol algebra. What would be interesting is whether you could quantize it. Quantizing it, I mean there really are operators somewhere, and a homomorphism from operators modulo is a natural ideal class, so that what you're getting for the deformation quantization is the symbols, full symbols of these algebras. Yes?
In some very loose sense, this is just a question of after you take matrix elements, the convergence of these series in T, right? Because using the symbol, I want to be corrected if I'm wrong, but I would have thought that using the symbol algebra, you could get a formal expression for every matrix element of every product of operators that, in the end, you know, take an arbitrary trace of products of operators. So you could get the matrix element by putting in appropriate things. It would be written in terms of the symbols, and the only thing that would be wrong with that is that you don't know that those series converge. Am I?
No, I think the problem is different than that, is because the symbols, that algebra that I've talked about, are functions on a cotangent bundle, right? Or on the sphere bundle. And that's the problem. If I were dealing with a sphere bundle, I might, which is much bigger than M, and it's an odd dimensional manifold, I might be able to talk about these algebras, their symbols, and their decomposition this way. But then I'm talking about multiplication by functions. I'm talking about functions which are functions on the sphere bundle of M, not of M itself. Remember, symbols for pseudo-differential operators are functions on the sphere bundle. And one of the reasons I gave this example is you actually are talking about functions on S1 because the sphere bundle is so simple. Still, it's in that sense that this work I alluded to last time of Vic Gilman and Boutet de Mauvin pays off. So what you actually do is this. So here we have our manifold M with this integral form omega. Because it's integral, we can find a circle bundle over M, let's call this P, with fiber S1, so that, and a connection alpha, one form alpha, on the principal bundle, so the d alpha is equal to omega. Then we'll have a measure mu on P which is d alpha wedge omega to the n over n factorial, which will be a measure on the principal bundle, and then we can talk about L2 of this principal bundle P. For purposes of discussion, because it gets kind of technical, it's even technical in general, but let's assume sigma is that M is just a surface, and then this measure is just d alpha wedge omega on the principal bundle, which is three-dimensional. So I'm going to assume that now this is two-dimensional, the principal bundle is three-dimensional, we have the circle S1. Now we can split this up because the circle's acting as isometries, preserving alpha. We can split up L2 of P mu into L2 P mu k, where the circle is acting like e the ik theta on the kth space. Now, what one needs is an analog of the decomposition that we use for Teplitz operators, a projection on the positive spectrum. The natural thing to do is take Dirac. So we're going to assume a spin structure on sigma, which means it'll have a spin structure on P. We'll take Dirac on P. Say it's three-dimensional, so spinners on the three-dimensional space are like spinners on the two-dimensional space. Total space is two complex two-dimensional, splits in half in the two one-dimensional pieces. We'll take Dirac on P, and so I should tensor everything with this spin bundle. It doesn't affect the analysis. And what you do is let E be equal to projection on the non-negative spectrum of the Dirac operator. The Dirac S1 will commute with S1 because those are isometries, commute with E because they're isometries. So we'll let the Hilbert space we want be E applied to L2, and then we can write H as a decomposition of spaces HK for each one of these splits.
So K is running over all integers?
All, but I'm only going to want to use the positive half because 1 over K is going to enter. Of Dirac, right. But actually, you're quite right, Greg. In fact, I had really would like to do this in a different way. Dirac on P is pretty close to D plus D bar on the surface and DD theta on S1. When you analyze it all, you really are going to be talking about only the positive spectrum. It's just going to come out right. So what we want to do now is take CDO on P and we want to take in the pseudo-differential operators, we want to take the ones invariant under S1, circles acting. Well, I want to do some other things, but what happens is if you analyze this, you'll find, first of all, what's going to happen to the symbols on P. You'll find that you're going to end up only with functions that come from M for their symbols. And so the kind of operators that will occur in here are operators of the form E, M sub F, E, as before. And you can show that modulo lower order, these are the only ones that are there. So that starts off the sequence of getting the first term in the expansion, because, again, the product of two such things will be this times modulo lower order. Well, in this way, if you check what lower order will mean, it'll be an expansion in 1 over k, because you, in here, you will be looking at 1 over d d theta along, this means along the circle direction, where you're going to get, this will actually, the way things are set up, will count the ordering for you for lower order, and so you get an expansion in 1 over k, and that plays the role of, in the general formulas I have, t will be equal to k, and that will give you, this will be an algebra whose full symbol with t replaced by k is a deformation quantization that we want for the functions on the manifold, and the kernel, if you look at the symbol map, are really what are called the smoothing operators in this algebra. Now, to get all these facts straight requires the technical developments where you extend pseudo-differential operators to a situation like this in general, and that's the reference I gave to the book by Victor Gilman and Boutet de Bonvin. Di is sitting back there for physicists who really want to know the details, because several of you asked me how you quantize a Kähler manifold. I'm sure that after he looks at those papers, he'll be able to, if he hasn't already, be able to explain the technical details for you. In fact, since physicists are here for a bit, mathematicians essentially have all left. Anyone left this? Well, a few of us are left. But those of you who are still here, there are some resources over in the math department. Di is there, and in C-star operator algebras, Ackerman's there, and there's a young chap in operator algebras too. What's his name? How do you spell it? B-I-S-Z-H? C-H. Are all knowledgeable about the things I'm going to talk about in a moment, so you might find that useful. Okay. Let's say more about the topology, the analog for the continuous functions, and what you want to do with the topology. Now, everybody, and I'll remind you, likes to discuss k of x for the continuous vector bundles over x in terms of c of x. That's easy, which is why everybody likes to talk about it. It's just the what I call the projective CX modules. That's just short for the following. If you have a vector bundle E over M, then you can find another vector bundle, E perp, so that E plus E perp is just M cross Cn for very large space. Then you have a nice the cross sections on here. They're very nice. And C of X acts by multiplication on those cross-sections. If you wish, you could say that that's just the function C of X direct sum with itself just n times. This would be a free module as it stands. And now how would you recapture the vector bundle sitting inside of here? Well, so the big one will be this bigger space Cn. E is a subspace, so you have a projection on the space at every point. So you really have a family of projections as you move along, and of course invariant under the multiplication by the function C of X, and really that's projection is where the word projective really comes from, and you're really saying, well, you're going to have a free module, and then you take a projection in it, invariant under C of X, so you're going to get a module on the range of P, and that is the projective module, and all vector bundles can be viewed in that way. Once you have said that, then of course you're going to define for any C star algebra A, it's got a unit in it, you're going to say that K of A is just the projective modules for A. And C star algebra I'm talking about. I think it works for any algebras that have a unit, as I recall. So, but people studiously avoid in an introduction of the subject is how does one see a cohomology. B of C of X. If you're only looking at the, say, continuous functions, how does one see the cohomology? Or if we want smooth functions, suppose we want Durham cohomology. Well, this is an issue that's come up a lot, for example, in algebraic geometry. And this is where Hochschild cohomology comes up. The origins of it really was an attempt to get at the cohomology of a space by only talking about the cohomology of a polynomial algebra of functions over the space. It's a long technical subject. I only want to make one observation that is the basis of it. And you get the cohomology, you're going to get at the cohomology by the following. We have given a current that is a linear functional on Q form, say a Q current, on smooth, if you wish, think of a Q cycle. I'm going to give you a linear, multilinear function, which let's call it tau sub c on which be equal to the integral over the current of the sum minus 1 to the permutation sum over Q permutation of F0 wedge DF1 wedge DF DF sigma 1 DF sigma Q. I write it that way purposely. I don't really have to take this. I suppose I got to divide by 1 over Q factorial. You leave the F0 outside. Now, if you stare at this long enough and are really clever, you can abstract from it what kind of functionals you really want to talk, multilinear functionals you want to talk about on the algebra that will reproduce this. So you, what you have are... No, I'm only doing the... I'm only telling you, well, these are ordinary functions. Yeah, I know. That's why I put the 1 over Q factorial. But the... I'm only doing functions now. I'm going to try and say something more a little later. But now having, the point is to try and say, get an analog of this purely algebraically, and it's done this way. We're going to talk about, a multilinear function from A to the dual space to A. Call this A star. T. So T of F1 up to FQ will be an element in the dual space, so it can be applied to function F0 to get a number. And now we'll be talk about the space of such T's, and we want to know what a coboundary is. B. If you have such a multilinear functional. So I have to tell you what BT on F1 up to FQ plus 1 is applied to an F0. Well, it's T of F2 up to FQ plus 1 apply to F0 F1 plus the summation of minus 1 to the jth T of F1 up to FJ FJ plus 1 FQ plus 1 applied to F0 plus minus 1 to the Q plus 1 T of F1 up to FQ applied to FQ plus 1 F0. I'm not sure I've got the signs right, but I think so. The whole point being that one will find that if you took this as your cocycle, that its boundary is zero because this is supposed to be closed, if C is a closed curve. And it turns out that this mapping, which will assign to currents to Hochschild cochains, will preserve the boundary operator and therefore give you an isomorphism between what's called the cohomology of A with coefficients in the module, the dual space, with the Durham cohomology as exhibited by currents. Now that's a big technical tour de force in algebra to be able to recapture cohomology this way. And it's the starting point of trying to say things in the non-commutative setting. So what should one do in the non-commutative setting? To try and imitate this. It's clear from this description what we need is a differential of an element in the space. And what's missing, I'm now sort of heading towards going from continuous to now smooth and metric considerations. I need somewhere a differential. So if I start out with this algebra A, this is now an algebra of operators, closed under star. But I no longer can assume, I don't want to say it's no longer uniformly closed, because that would give you all continuous functions. I just want, I need a notion of smooth. I need to be able to take the differential, at least, of something. And so we take our clue from this well-known fact, put it two ways. And one is that if you have the differential, suppose we're talking about C infinity of M, that if we have the differential, then the bracket of the differential with the function F, with multiplication by F, is really wedge by the differential of f. And if d of fg, well, the usual formula is what this says, okay? If we need, from the kind of analysis I've talked about, an elliptic operator. So it's better to take d plus del bracket with multiplication by f on forms. If you do that, you'll see you'll get wedge by df plus interior product by df. It's pretty close to Clifford multiplication if you think of forms as the same as the Clifford algebra. The critical thing is if you had a spin manifold, what is the commutation of the Dirac operator with multiplication by F? What it is Clifford multiplication by the differential, i.e., it's the summation of gamma j partial with respect to xj of F. And, of course, if you're thinking of a representation here, we're thinking here of the representation of the smooth functions on sections of spinners, so the natural thing is you're representing the differential on spinners in the usual way. So really, what we want to do is we have an algebra A. We have a Hilbert space H on which we're representing it. And we have some operator D, D, an unbounded self-adjoint operator. And the conditions we want is that D bracket A is bounded for all A in A. If you had a C star algebra, you would want to look at a subalgebra for which this is bounded. That would be, to some extent, not totally smooth. It would be, say, that the derivative exists and is a bounded measurable function, something like that, to allow. So that is the natural class to consider for smooth manifolds. And this would be the natural notion of the differential. So now we would say the one form in this category is just a summation of AJ, D bracket, AJ. That would be one form. And formally, you would multiply these things out. That would give you a K form, etc. To add some substance to it, to add the fact that this is in the right direction, let's talk about metric considerations. Pardon? Sorry. Thank you. No, that's just what I... Thank you. No. Dirac is not squared zero.
Oh. Oh. What's H?
H is some Hilbert space here. This is all represented on. In fact, in general, D, because as usual, you want something graded, you should really have two Hilbert space, just like plus and minus spinners, and your D star in D looks something like this. So we should be a little...
Can you define the analog of Dirac without defining the analog of D? Or you eventually get something that you would...
No, yeah.
The capital D I'm supposed to think of as the analog of Dirac.
Right. And you postulate it.
Yeah.
Period.
And little d doesn't exist at all.
Little d doesn't exist at all. Under special circumstances it might, but it doesn't exist. That's why I went from little d to this. Mm-hmm. Because you want something elliptic in the theory. Now, that this leads you to believe you're on the right track is the following theorem. Let M be a spin manifold. So that means it's Riemannian, otherwise we couldn't talk about spinners. Then, the distance between two points can be described entirely in terms of the Dirac operator. The distance between two points is the sup of the absolute value of f of p minus f of q over all functions f such that the bracket of Dirac with f has norm less than or equal to 1. So it's worth stating it by stopping for a moment so you absorb the statement. It says, if I want to get the distance between two points, P and Q, then look at the difference between F of P and F of Q. Take the maximum of this number, an absolute value, over all functions F so that Dirac bracket with F is less than or equal to 1. This norm is a sup norm of that one form. So this is the same as the absolute value of Clifford multiplication by df, you easily to check that this is the same as just the norm, not the L2 norm, but the sup norm of df itself. So now that's a nice exercise in geometry. I leave you to try for yourself to actually show that you can recapture the distance in Riemannian geometry. Just, of course, the Riemannian geometry is in here now, but that you can recapture it just knowing the norm of df and that this is a sup. Now, having said that, that's the beginning of the Riemannian geometry. If you have this space, you say, well, I'm in a non-commutative category, and somehow built into D is the metric built into D in the fact that I have a Hilbert space and a representation of my algebra in there. The metric is not explicit, but it's hidden in the fact that I have this self-adjoint operator D acting on a Hilbert space. Yeah?
So there's no real independent analog of differential topology. You just sort of automatically get Riemannian geometry.
There is another version of this where the analog would be taking D over the absolute value of D, we've seen it, as a bounded operator, and then replacing the situation by AH, and let's call this operator F. And then what you want is that F bracket A, because I've divided by something of order minus 1, is compact. That would be more differential topology, even though you've got the operator in there. And this is more geometry.
I don't understand. I mean, P and Q are supposed to be replaced by maximal ideals. So what is...
No, I'm saying... No. This is only a statement in the commutative case. So this theorem is really reinforcement that whatever metric you're talking about a manifold, it's all contained in this operator D, so that you have a lot of metric just by virtue of postulating the existence of this operator D.
Let me try and understand what a metric does for me. Does it give me a distance function on pairs of ideals?
In the non-commutative case? I don't know the answer because I don't know that there may not be any maximal ideals and multiplicative linear functions. I don't have points. Yeah. There is one case that...
Can I just ask something?
Yeah.
In this particular case, does the Dirac operator, is that really essential, or could you just use the exterior derivative to get a similar theorem?
You could use... exterior derivative, because it comes down to just df.
It's just df. Okay. So the Dirac operator doesn't play any particular role.
But what you need is ellipticity. So, for example, you see, you use certain things in elliptic analysis to tell you that you've got certain notions. Let me tell you what dimension is, for example. Right? Let me tell you what volume means, only knowing d, so to speak. And the reason that you can say these things is because you know what they are in the commutative case. So I remind you of the theorem that if you have the Laplacian on a Riemannian manifold and you take Laplacian to the minus s, that this is holomorphic in a half plane where the real part of S is greater than the dimension of the manifold over 2. And the residue of the first pole at M over 2 is equal to the volume element. Well, first, then, this tells us what you want to do is take trace of D, say, squared to the minus S. You're going to make assumptions that this is well-defined, and you look for where the first pole is, and you'll define that as the dimension of this non-commutative manifold. That's what you would do. Alain Kahn does this very elegantly using operator analog of trace, the Dichmier trace it's called, but the whole motivation is what I've just said. that you get the dimension by just staring at this function. And you make assumptions about what this D looks like, so you are going to be talking about a holomorphic function. And now the fact that you got the volume tells you that if you want to say what you mean by a linear functional on F, you would simply take the trace of F, Laplace of the minus S, and take the residue of that at the dimension over 2. That would really be, in the commutative case, the integral of F over the volume. So this way you would get the analog of a linear functional, which would give you the volume. Sorry, right. So as I say, there's a nice machinery that you don't see it in terms of residues, but in terms of the Dismier trace, it's called. Here's the case which, see if I can reproduce it. The case of 2 points, really, or you combine it with tensor product of 2 manifolds which are close together. Okay, so let's just take the case of 2 points. So we're now going to be talking about functions on 2 points, P and Q. That's a pair of functions, F and G, as we had before. And now, again, what he does is he uses 2 Hilbert spaces, H plus and H minus, because he wants a Z2 graded situation. And the representation on this pair is what you, well, since it's just going to act like that, these are sort of... see if I wrote it down. I'm confused about... my D is going to be an operator like this, acting on this pair. Gamma will be plus the identity, 0, 0, minus the identity. How does this pair act? I guess it acts like F and G. I think I wrote it down. Hold on. No, I don't have it straight, but so I can't make the computation at the board. But it's kind of cute that what D looks like is a matrix like this, and then you can use this, the formula for distance, and you find the distance between the point P and Q is 1 over lambda, where lambda is the maximum eigenvalue for this operator. And then in their analysis, Lott and Kahn analysis of weak electromagnetic, what they do is take 2 manifolds close together in the sense, so lambda will be big, and tensor it with the usual Dirac situation for the manifolds, for each of the manifolds. And that's how he gets some information, or reproduces to some extent. I'm not an expert on his development, interpretation of weak electromagnetic. But the basic idea is the tensor 2x2 matrices with the usual thing you do on a four manifold. And I presume that's what happens with D brains close together also. You just take the usual theory, tensor with a finite matrix situation, and write down what you want for D as an operator of this kind. So you see some virtue in talking about an abstract D in that it needn't be the Dirac operator or anything, as long as you've got something. Really, this is M is going to be non-singular, which is going to be elliptic. Yes. I was just thinking, taking the Hilbert spaces, finite.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So here there are points.
Yeah, I'm talking about...
Okay, so now we are talking about distances between...
Yeah, the basic... The,
are points maximal
ideals? No. I am taking the algebra to be a commutative algebra. It is C of X, and X consists of two points. That's the algebra. But the module that we're talking about is a little more complicated in the sense that even with discrete points, there can be an operator D which is non-trivial. This is what it looks like. And so you can go through the exercise of geometry with a discrete set of points and ask what the distance is between points. In this case, it turns out to be 1 over lambda. Yeah, I think, no, that's coming back. If I just took L2 as my Hilbert space, so that means the Dirac's two-dimensional space, the algebra is acting by F of P on one component, F of Q on the other. This permutes the two with a number, and then if you compute the distance in this sense, you'll get 1 over that number. So, I have described how you would get dimension in this abstract sense, how you would get volume, that linear functional, in this abstract setting, and how you would get what you mean by one-forms. As I said, a one-form is the summation of AJ D bracket BJ. And now you can be led in several directions. I've run out of time. Let's see what I... Well... You can go in different directions. If you have one forms, they're really connections, so you can talk about curvature by taking the differential of these one forms. You can talk about the analog of the Hochschild cohomology, where the cohomology will involve things like AJ D, well, AJ DBJ, DCJ, etc. And you could say what you mean by D of it. You're led to cyclic homology. You can say what these cycles are going to be like that you're going to get by taking certain linear functionals on here. And just like in the case of Teplitz operators, you got the index formula. Here you will end up with the analog of characteristic classes by taking the right linear functionals. So you'll get churn character development out of these considerations for the non-commutative case. Yeah?
Are there any results about uniqueness? I mean, I'm wondering, if you want to ask, you know, given some sort of operator algebra and some notion of distance,
what that, you know, reduces to the usual notion of distance when you have an actual manifold of metric and operators or something on it. Then you're sort of if I can work for the sort of construction that Colin has, something like that.
It's just sort of a shot in the dark. You know, here's something which seems to be analogous, but somebody might go off in a different direction and find another structure which is just as analogous in some sense.
You mean for a C-star algebra, or one of these algebras?
Yeah.
Well, I guess the analog for me to that question is, if you start out with the continuous functions on the space, it could have different differentiable structures. So you don't really have a uniqueness there. So you put in that structure and you study the theory depending on the smooth structure. Now, there will be a theorem that says the Durham cohomology is the same as some other cohomology, so even though it was defined in terms of the differentiable structure, that you will get something that's independent of it, but you use the differential structure to find some things, some of which are independent of it, some of which are not. So I think, I don't know, but I think the position of the people in the field is that you really want to take what you have learned from differential topology and Riemannian geometry and take a development in that direction. So, for example, I described the non-commutative torus last time. Well, now having said this, you might ask yourself, are they different just as they stand, as C-star algebras? Now I might want to put a differential structure on it. Well, for one thing, are they different? Can I compute the K homology for these spaces? If I put a smooth structure on it, can I get the analog of, say, the Gauss-Bonnet theorem? What's the Turing character look like? Now, for the non-commutative torus, there's been a lot of progress on that direction. So I described the non-commutative torus in terms of an irrational rotation. And it turns out that except for obvious things, these different tori, let's say 2t theta, that they'll really be different. The uniform closure will be different if the thetas are different. Up to what? Well, if you had minus theta, you'd get the same thing. If you translated by an integer mod, you'd get the same thing. But that's the only way you would get the same torus. And it's a rather delicate argument in the sense if you look at the algebra generated that we were talking about by U and V, then when you take the uniform closure, it turns out that there are projections in it whose dimension is theta. And those are the only projections in there, whatever you're allowed, theta, which translates mod 2 pi. Those are the only projections in there. The only projection have these dimensions. So if you had another theta, you would get projections with another of different dimensions. There's a unique trace in these algebras. So the dimension, if you fix the identity to be one, they're unique. So you do get you can distinguish these non-commutative tori. Alain Kahn has an analog of the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. You know, you start thinking about it. It's not hard to see what it is you're going to do with the differential structure. You're talking about AMN, U to the M, V to the N. You're thinking of this sort of as E to the I, M theta in one direction, and E to the I, N psi in another direction. Then the derivative you would just multiply this coefficient by M plus IN, say, as the notion of differentiating. And some things are easy and some things are hard.
So what's that cohomology?
They do talk about, they do describe the non-commutative. I don't know the answer, but they do describe the non-commutative cohomology for the for this. The right-hand side is a Chern character type formula. The left-hand side is the usual. Yes. And the point is to get an expression for the natural. You see, what happens is they're making assumptions when you take brackets. What happens is this. It gets technical. But when you take these brackets, all you know is they're compact. Bounded, I should say. You want to know a little more. Well, they're not going to be a trace class. But if you take enough powers of them, they will be of trace class. You know, enough products of them, they will be of trace class. So you've got to make assumptions about the brackets, that enough powers are of trace class, and then that means that you can take the trace. That's one side. The other... Pardon? Out of capital T. Somebody else is in here? That's a good way to end this. Yes, thank you. All right.